We got a lot of bills to consider today, so we're going to hop around a little bit until we get some other members here.
Slow down.
I think what we'll do, since we just have Pfizer and Representative Merkley is also here, is start with the housing bills. Is that what I'm saying to you? So I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3600. And that one is the individual development account. We have looks like a dash 3 amendment here. So, Representative Merkley, are you familiar with these?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chair. Should I explain this amendment?
Yes, please.
In working the bill through the House, a number of issues were raised, which I touched on briefly in the hearing last week, and this amendment addresses those that were raised. One issue was to clarify that one could not qualify for both a state deduction since one's donating to a 501c3 organization and also receive the tax credit. So the subparagraph 2 in the amendment starts on line 11, addresses that, lines 11 through 16 in the amendment. And therefore, if you take a federal tax deduction, which you would get for donating to 501c3, you cannot also take a state deduction and the tax credit. It also clarifies that in implementing programs, the ceilings in the bill are intended, in fact, to be ceiling, and reemphasizes that fiduciary organization can set up a program that has a ceiling, for example, of net income that is lower than the 80% of median income given in the bill, or in which people have less net assets than the $20,000 mentioned in the bill. So those are the main items that were corrected, and if we're ready to, other than that, I think we're ready to go.
Okay. There was one question that I had last time we heard this bill, and that had to do with this, and I'm sure you've taken care of this or have an answer for it, but household income for the area, is that clarified with this language about as determined by Housing Community Services Department? Do they do things by areas?
Yes, there is. They lay out for communities around the state, and they use this in virtually all of their programs, so that when they're using median income, they're using median income as adjusted for different sections of the state, and I think Mr. Schessler is here and could address that in more detail if the chair so desires.
It's fine if it's clear. It's not a redrawing of lines every time you look at an area.
No.
Okay. Ed, do you have anything to add? In our discussion or any change in the impact of the dash threes or anything?
No, Mr. Chair, I believe that this will not affect the caps which were placed on the possible revenue impact due to the monitoring arrangement involving the Legislative Revenue Office. That looks like it remains in place.
Okay. All right. Any other comments about this bill before we take some action to move it?
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Whitt?
Yeah, I know we've been, I know in the dash 3 amendments there's an effort to hone in or to target more specifically who this bill is designed to help. I'm concerned about a couple things. Number one, I think that the target remains overly broad. If I'm correct, I believe the net worth needs to be less than $20,000, excluding any value in a home, and that seems to me to be awfully high. In fact, I think that's, looking statistically, I think that's as much as a third or 40% of the population. And I think for this kind of a bill, we should be targeting people of low income and very low means, and I don't know that this bill does that in as targeted a way as it could. And that's a concern. You know, I want to be supportive of this bill, and in fact, I signed on to this bill, but I think it could be targeted more specifically to low-income people than the way it's currently written. And Representative Murphy and I talked about this, and I think he's made some attempt to do that.
Jim Murphy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, well, I talked with the various folks who crafted this, who are currently involved in IDA programs and are in contact with the national network. They said that this number was the national model, and that it was intended to be, in terms of the state statutory framework, a ceiling not to exceed, so one can take into account a kind of local initiative and judgment in judging what the ceiling should be. And so that is why we entered the language that clarifies that this is a ceiling and not intended to be the level that could very easily imagine programs setting a significantly lower ceiling as they wrestle with the design of this particular IDA program. I guess I'll frame it as a local control or local judgment or option issue.
Mr. Chairman, I believe the fiscal impact of this bill is limited to $750,000. Is that right, Representative? Now, that being the case, and in view of the fact that those are tax dollars that will not be coming into the state of Oregon, this has a relatively minor fiscal impact. And because of that, there's relatively few people that are going to be able to take advantage of the program set up under this bill. And based upon that, I'd like to see it really target the most needy citizens who could benefit from it the most. That's not going to keep me from supporting the bill, but I think it could be more specifically tailored. Right now, I think it's too broad in terms of its application as to who it can benefit, particularly since we're only setting aside $750,000 to accomplish this purpose.
Any other comments?
I would note that in testing out this framework, we'll probably learn a fair amount over the next 2 years, and there'll probably be at least half a dozen such programs set up, or maybe a dozen, and we'll be able to come back with experience, and we may find that we've set the income limit unnecessarily high or the assets, but I would be inclined to leave them during this initial experimental phase at the broader level to kind of learn and see what people do with this opportunity. I think Representative Wood's points are well taken, that is a significant amount of assets, and I think very few of the people, and probably none, who are involved in the current IDA programs would have such net worth. So the point is well taken.
Right, and I think Representative Merkley, you and I talked about this issue as well. I had a little problem with defining, basically half of the population as lower income households instead of the continuing victimization mentality here. But that's why I think the idea of E-3 that says that you can set much lower thresholds for this, that these are really the outer limit maximum. So I'm prepared to support the bill.
Mr. Chairman, one other comment.
Uh-huh.
The credit, reducing the credit from 50% to 25% of the amount contributed on Section 12 of the bill, page 5. Again, I'll still support the bill, but I think that really has the effect of making it harder to get contributions into this program. I would have much preferred to see it remain at 50%. Maybe Representative Merkley can give me some input as to why he chose 25%.
The intent of the team that drafted this was to leverage state dollars with private dollars. However, they didn't take into account that because the donations are made to 501c3, it makes one eligible for both a state and federal deduction. And so the -3 reformulates that, so you're eligible for the federal deduction, but only if you choose the state credit, you're not eligible for the state deduction. So cumulative, if I donate a dollar and I'm in a 28 or 30% tax bracket, I get 28 to 30 cents back from the feds and another 25% back from the state, so I'm roughly contributing half.
Yeah, I appreciate that clarification.
Okay. Any other comments?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rasmussen.
I move the Dash 3 amendments in the House Bill 3600.
Representative Rasmussen moves adoption of Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 3600. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rasmussen.
I move House Bill 3600 to the floor as amended with a two-pass recommendation.
Representative Rasmussen moves House Bill 3600 as amended to the floor with a two-pass recommendation. Is there any more discussion? Please call the roll.
Aye.
Representative
Hartley?
Aye.
Representative Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Representative Kelly?
Aye.
Representative Wells?
Excuse.
Representative Williams?
Aye.
Representative Witt?
Aye.
Vice Chair Rasmussen?
Aye.
Mr. Wilbeck? Aye. House Bill 3600 moves to the floor with a pass recommendation. Representative Merkley, you carry the bill. To a closet. For the work session on House Bill 3600. If we have everybody else here now, I think we'll hop around a little more. And go to House Bill 2473. And open up a public hearing on House Bill 2473. Hillary Abraham and Sarah Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Hillary Abraham with the Oregon Environmental Council. With me today is Sarah Dahl, our Environmental Equity Program Director. We'd like to thank you for a second hearing on this bill today. And at this time, I'll have Sarah deliver our testimony.
Thank you to the Chair and members of the committee for holding a second hearing on this bill. I'm not going to go over the same testimony that we had last time. We really think green taxes are a good idea and change about changing what we tax. There are lots of benefits to green taxes.
Sarah, could you identify yourself?
Sarah Dahl with the Oregon Environmental Council. Green taxes would give businesses and individuals more control of their tax burden. House Bill 2473 is good business. This study addresses a range of pollution sources, including individual driving, consumer products, and runoff. Industrial sources represent only a small fraction of many pollution problems and are not singled out in any way in this bill or green tax proposals. In fact, economic incentives such as those provided by green taxes are probably the only effective way to influence the thousands of individual everyday decisions that cause non-point source pollution from homes and fields. And if green taxes were eventually implemented for industry, they would provide powerful economic incentives for environmental performance, something most businesses currently criticize environmental programs for lacking. Finally, green taxes are an increasingly popular idea that will probably be proposed in the 2001 legislature in some form, regardless of whether or not the study is passed. And it makes sense for a business to be a part of the process to determine what exactly that should look like. We feel that the amendments that will be proposed, the representative would address the concerns raised by members of the committee during the first hearing. We worked really hard to make sure that we included all perspectives in this process. We had discussions with Legislative Revenue, and they're willing to administer the study. We want to be clear about one concern that was raised. Nothing in House Bill 2473 makes any statement about whether or not green taxes are a good thing or whether they should be adopted in Oregon. That's a decision for the 2001 legislature. Our intent is simply to make sure the legislature has specific, well-analyzed proposals to consider in 2001. Most commonly raised questions and concerns about green taxes are related to, can only be addressed by specific proposals or specific design rather than arguing about general ideas. The study will give the 2001 legislature the information it needs to decide whether and how these can be introduced in the state of Oregon.
Okay. Thank you very much. Are there any questions? Okay. I think we'll stand at ease for a moment. Paul, do you want to find out if the chair wishes to take this into a work session or if he wishes for us to go to another bill for a moment?
I'd be happy to ask a question while we're Could you clarify, please, the distinctions between the first bill and the dash one?
that there are a couple of changes that we added. We clarified the language a little bit so it was clear what the process was that the commission would go through in determining that they would have a series of potential taxes to evaluate and then go through a process where they selected a few of those for real in-depth critical analysis so that there's just it just clarifies the process a little more clearly and exactly what the criteria would be under which a specific proposal might be selected over another one.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I have a question. Just in the dash one amendments, I see that we've added a section 7 on page 2 that says legislative revenue. Provide coordination and staff support to the commission. How does that square with still remains in section 1? I guess the Department of Revenue appoints the membership, but the staffing is overseen by the Legislative Revenue Office. Is that it?
So, Madam Chair, Representative Shatterly, that actually is a technical issue that we would like to have clarified with another amendment. Essentially, we would like legislative revenue to both appoint the members of the commission as well as to have oversight. So that's just a technical issue that needs to be clarified.
Going to be shifting to LRO, and it's...
No, for consistency purposes.
Okay.
You're correct.
Okay, I'm going to ask Mr. Warner to present us with some additional information on the dash one.
Okay. Madam Chair, I was just going to summarize where we were from the last hearing, which was some time ago, and just the notes that I had taken and your response to that initial hearing. As Representative Shelley pointed out, the Legislative Revenue Office now has been specified as staffing the task force. But the comments that came from the initial meeting were, first of all, to make it less directive than the initial bill, make it more study-oriented, and to examine the appropriateness of the approach and have examples rather than more specific directives in terms of legislation. So those were the comments that came out of it, and that, I think, was the genesis for the Dash 1 amendment.
What did I miss?
Stunning testimony, probing questioning, clear definition of what it is we're doing, and we're now prepared to go into work session, Chair.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, bring back amendments.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative,
bring back more amendments.
Yeah, Hillary and Sir, I wanted to ask you on line 18 of the original bill on page 1. Did you want that to say legislative revenue shall appoint the balance of the membership?
Yes.
Is that the only additional change?
That is
required?
No additional change, just for consistency purposes.
Right. And Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I think the issue is that in the Dash 1 amendments, legislative revenue is going to be providing the staff support and the direction instead of the Department of Revenue. And to be consistent with that, on page 1, line 18, I think the only additional amendment that's needed, instead of it saying the director of the Department of Revenue, it needs to say legislative revenue shall appoint the balance of the membership. I would think, Mr. Chairman, that could be done very easily conceptually.
Paul, is that your understanding?
Yeah, so the Section 1 of the bill still has Department of Revenue. There are some specific members of the task force, and then the remainder are to be appointed by the director of the Department of Revenue. So. Conceptually, that could be changed to legislative revenue office.
Well, I guess I have a question if it really matters, since we're asking the legislative revenue office to coordinate this. Does it matter who makes the appointments?
Theoretically, there's no reason why you couldn't separate those two functions. It's just whether you want to make them consistent or not, and whether you want some consistency between who's staffing it and who's playing the lead in terms of determining the members.
Okay. Mr. Chairman? I think Representative Shetterly had a comment.
No, I think that was
here. Representative Williams.
I mean, I would agree that there were some concerns expressed, I think, initially to this issue of how this tax study commission gets staffed. And I wouldn't have any objection to the conceptual amendment. One of my concerns, though, is as I go through the list of who is appointed, maybe someone can help me out here, without having some amendment that specifies some involvement from the Department of Revenue, it doesn't look like we've got anybody on the commission who is from the Department of Revenue, which seems to me to be an important piece to at least have some participation. Now, whether they're staffing it or whether they've just got somebody showing up, I guess that's a different issue. But I don't see that mentioned anywhere in the staffing piece of this.
Mr. Chair, can I respond to that?
Sure.
Representative Williams, we've had discussions with the Department of Revenue, and they're very interested in participating. And there is, under, Section 2, Part 6, all agencies and departments and officials are directed to assist the commission to their extent, and the Department of Revenue understands that they will be a part of this process, and it's important for them to be involved.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
That was kind of a tying into my second concern. I think there were some of us on the committee that had a little bit of a concern about the broad nature of the authority given the commission under that phrase, all agencies, departments, and officers of the state are directed to assist the commission. Technically, that includes all statewide elected officers of the state who could be directed by this in a way that I think is a little bit concerning, frankly, in the broad scope of that language. I'm not sure how concerned anybody else is about it, but that was an issue that I think was raised initially.
Mr. Chairman?
Jay Witt.
It seems to me we pass legislation all the time that is signed by the governor that requires agencies to cooperate and to follow the laws that we pass. I guess I don't understand Representative Williams' objection. Specifically, if this bill becomes a statute and signed by the governor, it has the force of law. And it's obviously, when you have the force of law, you require agency cooperation in terms of fulfilling that statute. I think that's totally right and appropriate.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Shetterly.
I guess as long as it's understood that the assistance and the furnishing of information and advice is limited by budget and resources, and that there's nothing in this that requires specific budgetary expenses or staffing by other agencies or offices in order to accomplish this, but this is more an aspirational a directive to cooperate if that's what the intent is.
I think we've just created the trail of legislative intent here with this discussion. Any more comments?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I would ask that if conceptually we can change page 1, line 18 to the Legislative Revenue Office or language that Paul might think is appropriate there to describe that responsibility and take it out of the Department of Revenue.
We'll consider that and take action or comments on it as soon as we move into work session on public hearing. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
John Tapagna.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Tapagna. I'm a project manager with an economic consulting firm called Echo Northwest. We have offices in Eugene, Portland, and Seattle, and we've been in operation in Oregon since 1974. The Oregon Environmental Council asked me to comment on the feasibility of conducting an environmental tax study as proposed in this bill. Before doing so, I'll emphasize that neither my firm nor myself take a position on the bill, but are willing to comment on the feasibility of doing the work. Two conditions must be met before one would want to pursue this study. First, data must exist to estimate the effects of these taxes. And second, the study's funding must be sufficient so that an analyst could explore a range of effects on businesses and individuals, as well as alternative tax structures. with respect to data, the availability of information will vary depending on the text analyzed. Consequently, one of the first steps the proposed commission should take would be an inventory of the available data that various departments have. That said, I'm aware of data for a number of fees and charges discussed in the bill. For example, in past work, Echo Northwest has evaluated the revenue potential associated with automobile emission fees, drawing information from local and national surveys of vehicle ownership and use. Our economists estimated the aggregate health damage imposed by auto emissions. We also forecasted fee revenues by income class, assuming people paid fees proportionate to the damage they imposed. Our final report discussed the means by which the tax could be structured to mitigate the adverse effects on low-income people. The bill also mentions an analysis of industrial effluent or emission discharge fees. Those fees typically rise with the amount of toxicity and pollution that a firm releases. While Echo Northwest has not studied such taxes in depth, I'm told the Department of Environmental Quality, in compliance with the Federal Clean Air and Clean Water Act, routinely collects data on the volume of a host of regulated substances released by Oregon businesses. Information on other taxes, such as charges on carbon use or fees on toxic household products, could be gathered using existing surveys of consumer behavior and data from states that have implemented similar provisions. In short, if the study were authorized, sufficient information exists to produce useful and reasonable forecasts of revenues and incidents for a number of these proposals. Regarding the bill's funding, the proposed appropriation appears sufficient to complete the 2 to 3 in-depth studies called for in the bill. I appreciate the opportunity to testify and welcome any questions that you might have.
Okay. Thank you very much. Are there any questions? Thank you. Anyone else to speak on this bill, 2473? If not, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2473. Open the work session on House Bill 2473. And
Mr. Chair,
Representative Kasori,
I move the -1 amendment to House Bill 2473.
Okay, Representative Kasori moves the -1 amendment to House Bill 2473. Is there any discussion? Any more discussion on that? Any objection? So ordered. I would propose the following conceptual amendment, which does not conflict with the -1s, and that would be on page 1, line 18 of the bill, after Department of Revenue, to insert the words, and the legislative revenue officer. So it would read, the director of the Department of Revenue and the legislative revenue officer shall appoint the balance of the membership. So that way we get them collaborating. Is that okay? Representative Williams?
Mr. Chairman, it was my understanding the director of the Department of Revenue didn't necessarily want to be in the appointing position. I do believe they need to be involved. Certainly Section 6 of, subsection 6 of Section 2 would allow the commission to involve them, and I'm sure the Department of Revenue will be willing to be involved. So if you're doing that to quell my concern, Mr. Chairman, I think it's unnecessary. If the Legislative Revenue Office wants to have the appointing authority and are willing to accept that responsibility, I'm willing to go with that.
I don't think there's any disagreement between the Legislative Revenue Officer and the Director of the Department. They can exchange an email and probably come up with a suggestion.
Do I understand this has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means?
Yes,
that may be something that can be fleshed out.
To Ways and Means.
Yeah, my inclination would be to go ahead and get the bill on down to Ways and Means at this point, and if there's some further discussion to have with the Department of Revenue, they can fix that down there.
Okay. Well, I just checked with the revenue officer, and he's comfortable with that amendment.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative,
I'm supportive of that amendment.
Okay. All right. And the conceptual amendment proposed is to insert the words "and the legislative revenue officer" on line 18 after director of Department of Revenue. Does anybody object to that? So ordered.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Kikori.
I move House Bill 2473 as amended we move it to Ways and Means?
Yes, to Ways and Means.
Ways and Means with the due pass recommendation.
Okay, Kikori moves House Bill 2473 as amended to the Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there any more discussion? Would you please call the roll?
Aye.
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 Representative Wells?
Excuse?
Representative Williams?
Aye.
Representative Witt?
Aye.
Vice Chair Rasmussen?
Excuse?
Jeff Lovett?
Aye. House Bill 2473 will move to the Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation. Okay, close the work session on House Bill 2473. Thank you all for sticking with this bill and for modifying it in a more compatible manner. I think we'll run back up to the top of the agenda now. Go to 2982. All right. I'll open a work session on House Bill 2982. As you all recall, this was a bill that talks about financing capital construction in the school districts using a method of capturing the increased value that growth brings to a particular area. In essence, it has growth helping to pay for some of the school costs. Steve, do you want to kind of summarize what we talked about last time and introduce these amendments?
Okay, House Bill 2982, you should have, I'm four sets of amendments, the dash 5, 7, and 8. And when you do that, please check to make sure that on the date line under the bill number that there's a dash 1 under the date. You have the right version. Last time we talked about determining the tax on exception value, the school tax in particular, and then having that value not included as local revenue for purposes of the school distribution formula. And then that tax would then be for the school district. The first set of amendments, the dash 5, are different in two ways. One is a clarification of the definition of exception value to clarify that we're only talking about net exception value or the increase in the value because of the exception event that causes or triggers a new assessment of the property. So that's not a change in intent, but some change in language to clarify that. And you'll find that language on the dash 5, the first page, beginning in line 5, where the exception value is the positive amount equal to the difference, et cetera, between A and sub A and sub B there. So that's the clarification language. And the other change in the dash 5 is to limit the number of years that would not be included as school local revenue to 8 years. So prior to the dash 5, it was 10 years. And you also have the language in the dash 5 that would limit the school tax on exception value to be used for capital projects and would start in tax year 2001. So those capital project language was there before. The starting year language was there before. That's not new. But basically, the dash 5 is the same as the prior version that you saw, except that the number of years is decreased from 10 to 8.
Okay.
The dash 6 has everything but the dash 5 has in them with one exception, and that is on page 2, where the amount that's recorded is limited to 50% of the school tax on the exception value. Instead of the full amount, it's limited to 50%. That would not be included as local revenue in the school distribution formula. There's also a reference, let's see, and it's still 8 years total in that. That hasn't changed. So 50% from 100% of the school passed on exception value.
Okay, and then that has the effect of cutting the revenue impact
in half.
In half.
Okay. The dash 7, again, have everything but the dash 6 and 5 have in them. But there's this deals with urban renewal, exception value in urban renewal areas. And what this does is to say that 50% of the school tax that's generated by the exception value in the urban renewal area would go to the school district and not to the urban renewal agency. So it's a change in where the school tax, or half of the school tax on the exception value in the urban renewal area goes. He gets to use that revenue. There may be some problems with this. Council should probably address what some of those problems are trying to do this with in the urban renewal areas. But let me just touch bases first on the dash 8. Dash 8. The difference between the dash 7 and the dash 8, both deal with the urban renewal exception value, is on page 4 of the dash 8, where it's limited to school districts that exceed $50,000 or $50,000 in average daily membership dollars, as measured by average daily membership. So it's a further limitation on which urban renewal areas you would have the half of the school tax on the incremental value being available to the school district and not to the urban renewal agency.
And the effect of that is basically to narrow that to Portland.
Yes. Okay, I have one new table that I'd like to share with you, trying to come up with what that school tax on exception value is. You may recall that at the last meeting, or maybe it's been two meetings ago now, that I gave you a table similar to this, and it was based upon information received by the assessors, and we found that that information overstated the exception value. This table understates the exception value. Because you'll see that for some districts it shows zero. And that's because of the method that we use to calculate it.
They're pacing over there by the table.
Yeah, it shows zero for Portland, which is a little odd.
Now, what this does is to take the 98.99 assessed value and subtract from that the 97.98 assessed value increased by 3%. So this assumes that all property increases the full 3% allowed, and that's just doesn't happen. The exception value doesn't always exceed the 3%, and in those cases, I've zeroed it out rather than showing a negative. And so we know that this is underestimating exception value. The difference between this one and the other one, at least for this one, you can come up with a number for all school districts. The other one, you remember, had, I think, 6 counties missing in terms of the table, the assessor reporting the information on that table. We may have a couple more of those counties reporting, but not all of that information is available. But even if it were, it would still be an overestimate of exception value. So we still can't come up with a good number, even for 98.99, in terms of what that exception value is. It's the first year it's reported, so that there are some problems. Hopefully that would improve before the effective date of this in the year 2000. That's the only way to deal with it right now, I'm afraid.
So what we're seeing, though, Steve, on this third column, if we're understanding that we take this with a grain of salt, The third column is the tax amount, and what the bill proposes under the 50% of that would be half of that going straight to the district. Is that correct?
The half of it, yes. That would
half
be
included
in the formula as local revenue.
Right. And so what we can see is the areas that have the greatest growth are obviously going to have the greatest benefit to the local districts, but it's still fairly small numbers initially. Okay. I see Dexter is here. Why don't we talk about the urban renewal concept just for a moment, if you don't mind adding that in, since that was one of the issues that we did talk about, how this could benefit. I understand that there's a potential conflict between certain contracts that are already understood or relationships that are understood as far as urban renewal agencies and how this would divert the school tax portion of those funds.
Mr. Chair, members, good morning. Dexter Johnson, Legislative Council Office. Potentially, yes. I haven't been able had a chance to research this as much as I would like, but basically the federal constitution guarantees that contracts not be impaired by laws that are passed after contract is entered into. Existing urban renewal agencies have entered into have borrowed on the basis of pledging their increment, whatever that may be, but what they have essentially promised lenders is that whatever taxes we raise on our full increment will be used to pay principal and interest on the indebtedness that they incur. And what the Dash 7 and 8 amendments proposed to do is to divert a portion of that increment value and the taxes raised on that, send that back to school. And that, I think, with existing indebtedness, creates an impairment of contract because the increment that they've already pledged to be used for pay their debt is in fact going to be used for something else.
Okay, I think that is a problem, Representative Merkley. The part that confuses me here is that haven't they pledged the existing increment from the time the rate was frozen earlier? And new increment, as addressing to this, wouldn't this be an additional kind of on top of what's already been pledged to the renewal district?
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, what they have pledged is their increment value. And, of course, when you the so-called exception value in the bill is things like improvements and new construction that one could anticipate is going to occur. So under existing law, that is part of the increment. That is part of what is being pledged, the taxes which are going to be used to pay for this debt. And what this bill will do is say, no, we're changing the agreement a little because this is now going to be diverted for another use.
Even though the increase in property value from here forward couldn't have been anticipated by the contracts made formally?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, I think, in fact, it could have been anticipated because within a certain area, there is always going to be a certain amount of construction, and lenders are going to take that into account in deciding what risk, therefore what entity is going to charge for that. I think that is something that is considered at the time the agreement is entered into.
Okay. Thank you.
I still think, and obviously we've taken steps to have this whole urban renewal area studied and some results reported back for the next session, but I still think most people believe that the increase in value at least is paying for school taxes and things like that, and they don't understand that it's basically being siphoned off and they're going all to the urban renewal district or whatever gets to schools and other worthy causes. so that's why I thought this was a good idea, but it sounds like it might not be in conflicting with the already existing understanding.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
There is, at least with urban renewal areas that were in existence in 1997, something you could consider, and that is that they have this special levy authority, and the reason they granted that was for this very reason, because Measure 50 would have also impaired their increment value. Perhaps you could consider some modification that would to the special levy authority that would permit them to raise that additional amount. But that would be a general increase as well.
Yeah. I'm not really willing to go there. Okay. Any other questions for Dexter? Thank you very much. All right. I would like to propose that we sort of narrow our discussion to the -6 amendments, which Steve explained, shorten the time period from 10 years to 8 years, and they also cut in half the amount that would be going directly to local schools rather than the entire growth amount. And again, this is growth as determined by the assessors, and the exception value, half of that would then go to the school districts. And Steve, where's the definition of capital item?
In the -6. If you'll turn to page 5, lines 25 and 26, it's capital project as defined in ORS 280.060. And I believe I have that language with me if I can find it. Okay, 280.060 in 3 sub D says a capital project means the acquisition of land on which to construct a building, the acquisition of a building, the acquisition of addition to a building which increases the square footage of the building, construction of a building, construction of an addition, etc. Acquisition of an installation of machinery and equipment which will become an integral part of a building or an addition to a building, purchase of furnishing, equipment, or other tangible property with an expected useful life of more than 1 year, or a combination of these items.
Okay.
Very broad.
Really broad. And is this the same language that we used with the bonding in the previous session?
This is in the language for a local option tax outside the constitutional limitation. So it's what you would use if you were going for voter approval outside Measure 50,
okay,
as a serial levy.
Okay,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shittering.
I understand. I'm reluctant to move ahead with this, at least at this point, on it for a couple of reasons. One, that we just hear that the printouts, the run that we got, are incomplete and don't give the correct picture. And I'm looking, in fact, at Benton County, for instance, and in 3 of the 4 districts, it shows zeros. And we know that that's not accurate, but we don't know what the correct number is. I guess I have problems seeing myself going to those districts and explaining what's either in it for them or what burden they're being asked to bear when we don't have the information available for that. And secondly, I know that we have a bill out for a small school correction, and I think I need to know how that, if that's going to go forward, how that would net out with this and where that would leave everybody when the dust settles. And so I guess those are just my comments. And it's also one question to see. I see that the run that we have reflects the -5 amendments. Would that be different, even based on the limited information that we have, if the run reflected the -6 amendments?
Yes, it would be, because the -6 have the 50% of the tax, and the -5 is 100% of the school tax, but exception value.
So you just take that little column and cut it in half at this point. And again, this is outside the 3% growth level. Is that correct, Steve?
Yeah, the exception value above and beyond that.
There are certain kinds of property that are affected by exception value that that we wouldn't normally consider as new value added, and one of those that was pointed out to me is equipment that moves between code areas during the year. The value of that equipment may be at real market value both in the old code area and the new code area, but because of the way the statute is written, it would become exception value because it's in a new code area. That's one of the quirks of how the language works with the exception value.
Okay, Steve, when will you have numbers that would be rock solid as far as the assessment is concerned?
Next session?
Exactly.
In 2001, I suppose. But, I'm not sure how much better we'll be able to improve the numbers within a reasonable amount of time.
Right.
Just because have the time or opportunity, basically, or even perhaps the ability to improve the numbers that they have already submitted to the Department of Revenue.
Hey, William?
Mr. Chairman, perhaps it would be possible, however, to allow Representative Shetterly and others who have few concerns about the numbers in this report to talk directly to their county assessors to get a little better feel for what their county thinks their impact is going to be.
I think we need to kind of back up and take a look at sort of a general principle here. If we're talking about the high growth areas above and beyond the 3% already expected growth, that's where we're going to have the greatest number of students, the greatest amount of housing, the greatest impact on local schools, both in operating and on capital. Through the distribution formula, we're talking about helping small schools, helping a number of other various subcategories through tweaks in the distribution. We never, except for the facility grant, which is only a 3% of actual construction costs, talk about actually doing anything to help provide capacity and space for those areas. And it's, frankly, it's folks in Washington County and Deschutes County and Jackson County and the highest growing counties that have the biggest impact of the need for additional capacity. So where you're not going to have a whole lot of capacity, you're not going to have a whole lot of impact. But where it is happening, I think this is a tool that is desperately needed and is one that is really shortchanging all the students in those various areas that are high growing. So, Representative Witt.
I think rather than every member of this committee looking at what the direct impact is on school districts that they happen to represent, I think the principle is what's important here, and that is that we have districts and areas around the state that have very high growth. School districts in those areas are struggling to be able to provide the investment in capital equipment and land and facilities to be able to accommodate that growth. And I think this bill is a measured and appropriate and responsible way in which that can be recognized so that we can be fair in terms of providing funding to those districts that have a high rate of growth. So I would really encourage the committee to look at this from a principled standpoint.
Mr. Chair?
Okay, should
I don't disagree with the principle, and I certainly recognize the struggle that high growth districts have, but I tell you, I've been to the Falls City School District, and I have seen their entire high school class curriculum and their schedule on one page of paper, one sheet of paper, 8.5 by 11. And it would be hard for me to go back and face those folks. And again, I understand that we're here talking statewide issues, but I've got a lot of districts in my legislative district that would have a hard time understanding why, given the straits that they're in, we should be shifting dollars out of what amounts to their basic school support to address capital needs in high growth districts. And that's not to dismiss the problems that they have, but I think this is a problem that's really borne by the funding method that we have now as an outgrowth of Measure 5 and 50. And I don't think this fixes that. I think it shifts
dollars around, and though I'm speaking directly to districts in my legislative district, I think a statewide perspective would show that, in fact, even statewide, you're going to have more dollars going from more districts around to fewer districts that are these high-growth districts. And I don't know that necessarily, even looking at it on a statewide principle, if that justifies the approach.
Any other comments?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rasmussen.
I think that as I've been studying this particular proposal, I think that it represents a very strong effort to do some creative thinking and some outside-of-the-box thinking. But like all new proposals, it requires a little bit of time for everyone to become comfortable for deciding where they want to go with this, myself included. And would hope that while this proposal does not go away, we are given the opportunity to continue to discuss it among ourselves and our colleagues in this building.
How much time do you need for that?
A few more days at the bare minimum, sir.
Okay, Paul, would you reschedule this for Thursday, please? Work session for Thursday. We're going to move the bill on Thursday. It'll be up again. I would encourage you to take a look at the dash sixes and answer any questions that you have by that time.
Mr. Chairman, I'm supportive of the bill. I do want to ask the question as to why we went cut from 100% to 50%.
Well, that was in an effort, frankly, to respond to the comments of committee members last time we heard this bill that said, wow, this is too much, and it's taking money out of the basic school formula, the basic distribution statewide. So the amendment was proposed in an effort to meet those comments and the criticisms of the high amount of value. And frankly, you look at it, it is a lot of dollars. It's very expensive to build capacity, but I understand the comments of members who said, I may not have as much growth in my area, and therefore this isn't going to be as beneficial to me. So that's why I suggested the amount be cut in half, and also recognizing that the budget that's set and the ADMW amount that's set at the state, and what we look at is local revenue, and then everything else is made up with state revenue. So I think whatever budget we set for school dollars could be met with decisions that are made within this building, and not necessarily seeing this as a loss of some sort of local dollars.
And Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to make the point. I'll support it if that's what becomes necessary to move this bill, but I would have preferred to leave it at 100%.
Thank you. Representative Merkley.
Well, Mr. Chair, when we first had testimony on this bill, the county assessors raised the question about whether they had the software that would make it feasible for them to track this. As in this new formulation of exception value, do we have that problem solved?
Steve, do you know the answer to that?
Mr. Chair, yes. The question I had was that yes, it did, because the original bill would have required the assessor to keep track of exception value on each property for the full 10 years at that time in that bill. We have changed that so that in the current year, once that exception value and tax on that exception value is set, you no longer have to identify it with the property for the next 7 years. And so that was trying to address the assessor's comment.
Okay. Thank you.
And of course, I know that's still okay.
That was another change we made to freeze the value rather than have it compound.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Kapoor.
I'm sure my comments will come as no surprise when you look at the zeros next to Portland on this run that we've received. It's not that I think I understand what Representative Witt was saying about, you have to look at the statewide picture and whether this is a good policy. But I think, is it really good policy to look at adjusting one aspect of the formula at the expense to others? I mean, there the small school piece that Representative Shetterly brought up, and also there's poverty adjustments that could be made. I mean, I think that taking one aspect of the formula out and addressing it is, I don't know if I think that that's necessarily good policy.
Okay, let's not do the poverty adjustment. Good idea.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Witt.
I think you have to look at these adjustments on a case-by-case basis based upon the principle involved. And I could support adjustments relative to poverty level and other adjustments, but you can't always deal with those as a package. And this is an adjustment to the formula that I think is appropriate. It's fair. It does recognize that there are additional costs for these high-growth districts, and it tries to make some reasoned and responsible accounting for that. So, you know, I wouldn't oppose this simply because there's other adjustments that may have some legitimacy as well.
And I think we, just a moment, please. I think we heard testimony early on when we talked about various formula. I think it was actually in my bill to eliminate the weights, that the whole idea of the formula was to take into account situations in local school districts and distribute state resources and local resources where the need was greatest. That's why we have the weights. And that's, I don't think we can just say if that was true back in 1990 or 91, that therefore nothing ever changes and everything is fixed in time. Okay, Rasmussen?
Just in terms of a generalized argument about principles and formulas, I'm now seeing the run for doubling the poverty factor. And it does a very nice thing for Portland. It brings us an additional $5 million fairly quickly, at the expense of about $5 million hit to Beaverton, and it also hits Tigard, and it also hits Hillsborough, and it also hits a number of the large urban school districts. So, again, I end up looking at this going, gosh, it would help Portland, but on the principle of saying there's some other damage going on in the state that I'm not sure I can support. So, you can't, I don't know, you just, I find it difficult to look at one thing or another in isolation. I do look for the context, and I do try and make decisions for the whole state.
Okay. We'll have this back Thursday. Close the work session on House Bill 2982. Open the work session on House Bill 3405. That one here. Who's that? Here we go, Ed. Ed, you want to remind us what this bill is and talk about the dash twos?
Before opening.
Mr. Chair, House Bill 3405 would allow a subtraction to be taken from corporate and personal taxable income. Or the difference between the fair market value and the sale price of land donated or sold to school districts. This would, in effect, replace the current treatment for that those donations would be eligible to receive, which is to be taken as an itemized deduction and subject to the income limitations that apply to all or most itemized deductions.
Okay, and the next two.
Dash twos just clarifies how the subtraction is computed and standardize the language with respect to the language in Internal Revenue Code Section 170, which governs charitable contributions. Clarifies how the carry forward is to be applied, and that's about it. Just some technical corrections to make the mechanics of the bill more compatible with the intent of the drafters.
Okay. And what is the revenue impact?
The revenue impact is minimal, if anything. It's the impact would be the marginal difference between what a taxpayer could claim as an itemized deduction versus what he could get as a subtraction. And an individual basis, that might be fairly significant to the individual taxpayer, but we haven't been able to identify any cases where this might apply. And certainly in the near future, and probably in the next biennium.
Okay. All right. Any questions on this bill, Representative Merkling?
Yeah, I'm still a little confused about it. If I'm selling a piece of land that's valued through an appraisal at, say, $1 million, but I sell it at $800,000, so I have this $200,000 difference. Is that additional $200,000 that I can treat as if it were an itemized deduction?
Not, Representative Murphy, not an itemized deduction, but as a, it would be eligible for a reduction in your taxable income, subject to the limitations on the amount you can claim in a given year.
So I can carry it forward.
That's correct.
Under this.
Unused portion could be carried forward for up to 15 years.
Well, I guess I'm missing the distinction between that and an itemized deduction.
Mm-hmm. Representative Merkley, the distinction is pretty minor and pretty technical. There's reduction that can apply to your amount of itemized deduction you can claim if your income gets above a certain level,
mm-hmm.
and that level is around $112,000, I think, for the current tax year. And that treatment passes through from the federal to the state for treatment of certain itemized deductions.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, what you're saying is under this bill, you would escape those federal limitations.
Representative, that's correct with respect to the Oregon, amounts could be subtracted from Oregon taxable income.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rasmussen.
But given all of that, do you still feel that the overall revenue impact to the state is about the same, and we're not making any major shifts one way or the other?
Vice Chair Rasmussen, yes, and the reason is because we cannot identify any transactions that are either in the pipeline or about to take place that would be able to benefit from this.
Okay.
And then in the event one did occur, the benefit would be fairly marginal and limited to the difference between what could be achieved under the two treatments. Like I said, in a specific case, as yet an unidentified case, it might be a substantial difference.
Representing what? Ed, to go back to this to make sure I fully understand, if someone donated $5 million worth of land, for example, to a qualifying institution under this bill, and presumably this is a high-income individual who would not get the benefit under the federal code unless under the state code in terms of a deduction, what they would get in terms of the maximum benefit under this bill would be about $450,000 of tax relief, because all it is doing is reducing that from taxable income for Oregon income tax purposes. Is that correct?
Representative Witt, that is correct. That it's applied as a reduction in taxable income, not as a credit. And the amount that could be claimed in the first year and in subsequent years is limited by taxable income in that year.
But the benefit to the qualifying institution, to the school district, for example, is at least 10 times what the cost is in terms of revenues, lost revenues. Wouldn't that be correct?
Representative, if that's what you're applying, the 9% market factor, that's absolutely correct.
Yeah. Mr.
Representative Rasmussen.
I would be interested in supporting this bill. I have one probably not overwhelmingly surprising question for you. Wondering if you would be interested in applying a sunset to this bill so that we have a make sure we come back and double check that it's doing what we want it to be doing.
Yeah, I don't see the need for a sunset. I mean, it's going to take years for this to work. I mean, you know, it may be 2 years, 4 years, 6 years down the road before people start using this in a significant way. And I think when you look at the fact that the benefit here to the taxpayers, to the public, is more than 10 times any tax benefits to the donor, we should be encouraging these kinds of things, not discouraging them. And frankly, it could be 2, 4, 6 years before this is used, but when it's used, it could be used very significantly to help reduce the cost of acquiring land and facilities for school districts. So So I'm very supportive of this, and I don't see the need for the sunset.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Rasmussen?
I don't see applying a sunset as being a discouraging thing for passing a new or changing how we treat some of our tax credits. I see it as simply good governance for a term-limited legislature. I would certainly support a 6-year sunset or even a 15-year sunset if that's the pleasure of this committee. But I think it's I think that it is wiser of us to apply sunsets to all new credits, no matter how worthy their cause is.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Shetland.
Just one thing for the record. I raised a question about this bill. I'm supportive of it. I raised a question about the bill on page 2, line 2, where it talks about if a partnership or S corporation makes a qualified donation. And when this was up last time, I asked, what about, for instance, limited liability companies? And I did get a response from the Department of Revenue that seemed to satisfy them, basically that they tax LLCs. That is, if a limited liability company is taxed as a partnership under federal law, then it's treated as a partnership under state law. I guess if that's clear enough to them, it's clear enough to me. If there's a problem with that, I guess we can always come back and revisit it. But that was my only question about this bill.
Okay. I did have a note about that. Thank you for following up. Okay, any other discussion? Representative Witt, you have another amendment here.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I have it's shown as the -1 amendment to the bill, and what it does is it provides the same opportunities that the bill provides to, I think the language is public, common, and union high schools, to private schools, and to accredited public and private community colleges or universities located in the state, to provide the same opportunity for those institutions to get land at a less than full market basis or to get it as a donation and provide, in those cases, the donor the same tax consequences as the original bill provides for the contributions of land or the value of land to a grade school or high school district, a common or high school district.
Okay. Well, I chair move -2 amendments to House Bill 3405. Is there any more discussion on that? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rasmussen.
Would you be willing to consider a conceptual amendment to add a 6-year sunset?
I suppose that would be, I think maybe it ought to be a little longer.
That would be of interest to you, sir. Would you like to go for the full 15-year run?
Well, it doesn't really, the 15, it still has a tail, even
right.
If somebody qualifies.
Right.
It takes a while to get.
You want to take it out?
Pardon me?
You want to take it out to an 8-year sunset?
I think that would work better, give everybody time to have some experience with it.
And Mr. Chair, I'd like to move a conceptual amendment that would add a 8-year sunset from the implementation of this bill.
Okay. Representative Rasmussen proposes a conceptual amendment to add an 8-year sunset to the bill. Is there any discussion on that issue?
Mr. Chairman, I'm opposed to adding a sunset. Again, the benefit to the institution is at least 10 times what the cost is to the state. And I think we should be encouraging those things and giving them a real good opportunity to develop instead of putting a sunset on this bill the moment we pass it. To the extent that there's land contributed to school districts that can benefit under this bill, we're saving taxpayers $10 or $11 for every dollar it would cost in terms of any potential taxable benefit. know, this is a darn good idea. It's something we should have done a long time ago, and to immediately put a sunset on it, I don't think is justified.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Mercury.
I would support a sunset because the question remains unanswered of whether this additional amount is an incentive that actually alters behavior or whether it becomes an additional amount of funds simply in the pocket of the donor. It's been clarified that in many cases, donation of land, there wouldn't be a distinction. It's only for certain donors would gain additional benefits. And the challenge of putting a sunset on at a later point is that it potentially runs into the 3/5 vote ruling, so it makes it much harder to do it, whereas if we do it when we set it up initially, we can easily remove the sunset at a later point. We can't necessarily easily terminate or add a sunset. And it's for that reason I would support Representative Rasmussen and her suggestion.
Yeah, and I think as we went through the tax expenditure report, I think our general principle on many of these items was to have the opportunity to review these sort of on a mandatory basis. So while I'm not crazy about the sunset, I won't oppose it. Okay, we have a motion for a conceptual amendment to add an 8-year sunset. Representative Witt objects?
I do.
Okay. Representative Welsh objects. Any other objections? That amendment is adopted. Senator Witt, do you want to propose your dash one?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would propose the adoption of the dash one amendment to House Bill 3405.
Okay, discussion on that motion.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rasmussen.
I would like to see us get used to this bill for a session or so before we expand it out to additional organizations that is listed in the dash one amendments. I also have a concern, perhaps our staff can help clarify this, but I'm not sure we have a revenue impact that includes more coverage for private or the higher ed section.
Let me ask that in another way also to staff. Do private institutions and colleges currently have the same enjoy the same status as the public schools when you're talking about donations earlier and in essence the cancellation out of the revenue impact?
Mr. Chairman, I believe so. If they're 501c3 eligible type foundations or corporations that support either individual schools or perhaps groups of them, and the donation were made to that entity, then it would qualify for deduction under current law.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Witt?
I have a letter and opinion from Legislative Council, and it does confirm the point that Ed is making, namely that donations of land or property to educational, charitable 501c3 organizations do presently provide tax benefits to the donor. What we're doing in House Bill 3405 is we're expanding out when those deductions are available to a broader class of taxpayers for a longer period of time. And since the purpose of 3405 is to make property and land available on a donated basis to hold down the cost for taxpayers and for public institutions, particularly in this case educational institutions, I think the same expansion to private schools, universities, and community colleges makes total sense from a public policy standpoint, and is consistent, I think, with what the law says now relative to the deductibility of these kinds of contributions.
Mr.
Chair. Jenny Rasmussen?
I withdraw my objection.
Okay. There's a motion before us to adopt the dash one amendment. Is there any more discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, the amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Rasmussen?
I move House Bill 3405-34 as amended with a two-pass recommendation.
Okay, Representative Rasmussen moves House Bill 3405 as amended by the dash ones, the dash twos, and the conceptual sunset amendment to the floor with a due-pass recommendation. Is there any more discussion? We call the roll.
Aye.
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 Representative Welch?
Aye.
Representative
Williams?
Aye.
Representative Vick?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Aye. House Bill 3405 will move to the floor of the due recommendation. Would you like to carry the bill?
I would, Mr. Chair.
Representative Witt.
Thank you.
Okay. Close work session on House Bill 3405. And we're going to move to 3211. We're going to open a work session on House Bill 3211.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Kapoori.
I move House Bill 3211 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Representative Kapoori moves House Bill 3211 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there... Actually, before we go into discussion...
Oh, I didn't get the...
amendment?
The amendment. Sorry.
I don't have any...
I withdraw my motion. Dash one on my file.
Before he withdraws the motion, let's start over again. Elizabeth, can you tell us where we are with this bill?
I don't have the dash one. I'm
not sure. They were distributed at the last meeting.
416. Sorry, Mr. Chair, those are mine.
Did you give them to anyone else?
Yes, they were distributed at the last the public hearing. They should be in your file.
Yeah.
Or mine were.
Yeah, I have mine.
That's where I live.
Okay, well, the would you want to explain what the dash ones are, Representative Kapoori?
The dash one amendments are mostly, they were just... There were some mistakes in the original draft in the bill. They were just clarifying that this is rental housing. And I don't think there was any particular. They didn't take, that was what people were testifying to for the dash one amendments, actually, when we had the public hearing last week.
Okay. Well, I don't really feel comfortable moving forward with it. If staff hasn't had time to analyze them. And
could I ask Mark Landau from the City of Portland to
sure.
explain to us the dash one amendments?
If he's willing.
It does appear to have some reference to it in the City of Portland testimony.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Mark Landau with the City of Portland's Office of Government Relations. The Dash 1 amendments primarily are some technical corrections that we provided to Representative Kapoori. Furthermore, our intention, we had tried to accomplish two things with two different bills. We also, with 3207, which is now being used by Representative Merkley for another proposal. In this instance, these amendments primarily, as I said, are technical and just further defining the preservation of rental the preservation of rental properties.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Merkley.
In deleting all of these phrases where it says rental, are we broadening this to include non-rental property?
Who are you directing your question to?
To Mr. Landau.
Okay.
You probably could define it as such, Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley. However, I think that what you see is that we are also inserting housing there, but for our purposes, we are looking at rental housing that are subject to contracts either with the state or the federal government for low-income housing.
Representative Merkley, I think that the phrase low-income housing assistance contract is a phrase that has been used in other areas, and it's an agreement between a public agency and a property owner that results in the production, rehabilitation, or preservation of affordable housing within a defined level of household income. So that phrase is a defined phrase. That's why we changed the rental to housing.
I think actually, though, before we go any further with this, we need to get this all straightened out. I'm not comfortable passing our bill. We're still squishy on it. So thank you, Mr. Landauer. We'll... Okay, so would you please copy okay. that and do your analysis, make sure it's what we intend?
Mr. Chair.
Do you want to
reschedule this bill for Thursday as well?
Well, I'm not sure what else is up on Tuesday, but it'll get rescheduled. Wednesday? Okay, we can put it up Wednesday.
Wednesday's great.
Okay, close the work session at 32:11. And open the work session on House Bill 2087. We don't want to have two staff, the same staff person twice in a row.
These guys working out.
Okay, Ed, do we have any amendments? Is anything different on this bill?
Well, Mr. Chair, we haven't had any requests for any changes to House Bill 2087.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Shetterly,
I move House Bill 2087 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Shetterly moves House Bill 2087 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Please call the roll.
Representative Rosenbaum? Aye. Representative Shetterly? Aye. Representative Wells? Aye. Representative Brewing? Aye. Representative Britt? Aye. Representative Wright? 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 Aye.
House Bill 2087 moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Shetterly, would you carry the bill?
I'd be glad to. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2087 and open a work session on House Bill 2090. Let's change staff one more time. But before we get to that, actually, Mr. Lamb, you want to come forward? And I had talked to you earlier about a bill that we had planned for a tap-in hearing. And I don't know if you have the essence of that here, but I did want to give you the opportunity on one of these bills that had to do with low-income housing to present that information. If you're not ready today, we can do it on Wednesday, but you'd prefer.
I can do it.
Okay. It's when we do take it on the time. Sorry to catch you unaware there, Mr. Lamb.
I expect a little later. Hang on.
Like I said, we could do this on Wednesday if you prefer. I just apologize for not getting that on the TAP list, which actually gets more time than, you know, the 3 seconds it would take to open the hearing.
Jerry Schroback, members of the Revenue Committee. My name is Donald L. Lamb, and I'm speaking to you today as the board chair for St. Vincent de Paul of Lane County, and it's concerning House Bill 3271, which is a low-income housing tax credit for single-family homes. And what it is, and I'm not sure, is the vehicle in which individuals in low-income housing who are in permanent affordable housing are able to move into single-family residency. And the problem, quite frankly, is to find a way to finance the equity that's necessary between the loan amount that the low-income family can afford, which if we're dealing with a home 100 to 120,000, in other words, 1,000 to 1,200 square feet, they can afford somewhere in the neighborhood of around a $70,000 mortgage at 7.5% interest. So you're looking at a $30,000 to $40,000 equity in which the individuals are unable to come up with. And quite frankly, no commercial lender is willing to do a second behind to pick up that, and the people couldn't afford it. So what this bill does is take the concept that we have in the federal tax credit and modify it down to a 7-year period and do it through state tax credits on a limited partnership basis. And that 7-year period is the time in which this nut, so to speak, this $40,000 equity is created for the parties, and this is done through a nonprofit corporation being the general partner and controlling the property. When that time lapse is gone, the tax credits are paid out, then the home is formally transferred and sold to the individuals that have been living there on a lease option, and they own the home. And the equity then is secured for them. And if they, in the case of St. Vincent de Paul in Eugene, we have a what we call a soft second behind ours for this equity. And if the party moves the next year and tries to take that $40,000, so to speak, and run with it, it's a declining balance. The number of years they live in, it's one-tenth a year that comes off. So that money then comes back, and we reinvest it back into the housing programs. That's what the program is. It's a part of this continuum that we need to free up space in the affordable housing market, and at the same time, let everybody have their dream, and that is to attempt to create stable financing, stable school, and situations for the individuals in rural health and housing.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Thank you. What our staff to do is to take a look at the bill and look up a revenue impact on it, and we'll take a look at
it. Schroback, I had actually a member Senator Minsker's staff do an insert there, which is, I don't know if that's gotten that. That's based literally on the St. Vincent model in Eugene that we have figures on that. Representative Merkley had asked a question earlier in the week concerning what it costs to buy these top tax credits. And I confirmed again that we're at roughly 8%. So I don't know if that figure had been sent up from our office in Eugene, but approximately 8% is the overhead cost to the tax credits, not the higher figure that we had in mind.
Mr. Chair, I'd have to see the spreadsheets in order to understand that we're talking about apples and apples. The point I was raising
is not one I want to spend time addressing now since we have other housing bills on the table, but I think it's an important one, which is the syndication of tax credits is a very complicated process with a steep overhead in it, and essentially it's complicated enough that when we start to get into it or we won't get to our other bills on the table, but it's a very interesting idea that's been brought forward and worthy of consideration.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lennon. Okay, I'm going to, I don't remember, what, did we open anything yet?
I think you opened 2090.
Did we open 2090 yet, Barbara? I don't think so. Okay. Open a work session on House Bill 2090. If we didn't do it before, we're doing it now. This is another one of the housing-related bills that we heard. Elizabeth, this looks like a new revenue impact from the one that stated 224 to now 426.
Yeah, Chairman still recommended to the committee. I didn't change this as far as the actual numbers or anything. There was a question about the exact number of properties in the city of Eugene, and so that was taken out. So basically, for this bill is extending the deadline for the property tax exemption for a property owner to construct low-income housing units from January 1st of 2000 to 2010. So what I have assumed is that over the next 3 years in the biennium, or next two bienniums, there would be three additional housing units that would go and be able to claim this property tax exemption now with this increase at the sunset. And so this would correspond to approximately 37,000 in the first biennium and 189,000 in the second biennium, just due to these new properties that would be allowed to come on the roll between the years 2000 and 2003. But obviously this is, since they are allowed an exemption for 20 years, this revenue impact goes much beyond 2000.
Sure. Okay.
Are we in work session?
Yes, we are.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2090 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Rasmussen moves House Bill 2090 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Please call the roll.
Representative Croy.
Aye.
Representative Murphy.
Aye.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Aye.
Representative Skelly.
Excuse.
Representative
Wilson. Aye. Representative Williams. Excuse. Representative Witt. Aye. Vice Chair Rasmussen. Aye. House Bill 2090 will go to the floor with the due pass recommendation. And Representative Welch, since we have Eugene testimony, would you carry the ball?
I will.
Thank you. Okay, I close the work session with House Bill 2090. Chair requests unanimous consent that the rules be suspended and that Representative Rasmussen be allowed to vote on House Bill 2473. Any objection? Oh, come on. Hearing none, Representative Rasmussen, how do you vote?
Vote aye.
Votes aye.
We have two colleagues that may wish to add their votes to the bill we just worked.
Oh, sure.
3271.
That was long.
Oh, 20 to
zero. Yeah. Why don't you just vote yes on the floor, unless you feel strong.
Oh.
You want to vote on the 2090 since we just did it?
Come on over here, please.
Okay. Chair requests unanimous consent that the rules be suspended that Representative Williams and Shetterly, who were out in the hall, be allowed to vote. House Bill 2090.
Smoking a cigarette.
Raising money. Is there any objection? Okay, so ordered. Representative Shetterly, how do you vote?
How did everybody else vote?
It was a yes all around.
Yes. Yes all around. Not that I'm influenced by my peers.
Representative Williams, how do you vote?
Williams votes aye.
Okay. Thank you very much. I have some questions about 3207, so we're going to hold that one off. We'll get back to that one.
Thank you all for hanging with us today. We've got through a lot of material. Floor 10:30, committee's adjourned.
Yeah, if you'd... Yeah, absolutely. I don't think we'll have any trouble.